After months of practically living in the desert down in Southern California, stepping off the climate-controlled 747 onto the tarmac in Ecuador was like entering a sauna right out of a refrigerator. My assistant and I touched down at Simon Bolivar International Airport near the coast and were greeted by a deeply tanned blonde gentleman in khaki shorts and a maroon polo shirt ringed with sweat. He introduced himself as Joe, speaking with a Tennessee twang as he folded up the large card marked Dr. McNeil. Joe informed us that we would be taking a taxi to the port where a small water plane would transport us to the elevator. I knew the space elevator project was just off the coast, but I hadn't expected the terrifying taxi ride through the bustling city of Guayaquil. I was glad I hadn't eaten on the flight when the prop plane jerked and stuttered its way on a two-hour trip to the middle of nowhere in the Pacific. As the platform rose out of the ocean, its single gray tower seemed to grow taller by the minute. Below it, a large mass of steel girders, warehouse-like structures, pipes, containers, and massive moors sank into the roiling surf. I strained to see the cable stretching into space from one of the uppermost decks, but it was too small to be visible. Large construction vessels surrounded the floating metal island, cranes lifting containers and other equipment onto loading bays where ant-like workers scurried about. As we descended, the pilot shouted something that sounded like a warning of a rough landing. I gripped my armrests, uncertain what to expect from an ocean-going plane. The touchdown was no more violent than heavy turbulence. Soon, the platform towered above us, and the massive moors and splashing waves filled the viewports. We approached a floating gangway that rose and fell with the swells, making it a challenge to judge when to step onto it. My assistant almost fell into the surf, but I grabbed his hand and steadied him. We climbed about 5 windy flights of stairs in the midday heat before reaching the air-conditioned comfort of the administrator's offices. Joe led us to an office where we met Dr. Jones, who asked us to sit before Joe left. "Hello and welcome to this space elevator, Dr. McNeil. I trust your flight wasn't too bad?" "It wasn't as bad as I expected, but my breakfast almost came up a couple of times." He chuckled and nodded towards the seats in front of his cluttered desk. We sat down, and I asked, "How long before you have this thing operational, Dr. Jones?" "My, but you do like to cut to the chase. I assume you have some pressing need for our services soon?"
"I prefer not to waste time with pleasantries. That, and I want to get to my room and a wash closet promptly. I'm sure my assistant, Mr. Brown, feels the same way. The sooner we can start ferrying our raw materials and equipment into orbit, the better."
"The progress on our elevator has been very promising and seems to have accelerated since the money arrived last May. However, its completion and capacity to haul heavy loads up out of the gravity well have variables that need to be discussed before I can give you an accurate timetable. May I suggest Joe take you to your rooms to freshen up or nap, and we can discuss this while you take a grand tour of the facility?" I looked at my watch, hinting at my impatience. "I suppose. Perhaps Joe can show us to the cafeteria or whatever you call it here as well?" He nodded and made a phone call. Several minutes later, Joe returned, announcing, "The weather is getting pretty foul out there." The good doctor arrived just in time. "I'll take them to their rooms with a detour by the mess before it gets worse." I turned to Dr. Jones and asked, "Will you send someone to get us when the weather permits a tour?"
"Absolutely. I hope your stay here is pleasant, though we are not a classy hotel by any stretch. But the accommodations should be satisfactory."
"Thank you. I'm sure they will be. We didn't come here for a vacation, so any comfort will be a pleasant surprise." We made our way into the now furious elements, holding onto the handrails for dear life between decks. The sky was dark lavender and blue as the sun set behind angry clouds. I could have sworn it was clear when we arrived, but the impressive sight of the elevator had distracted me. Soon, it started pouring, and I was drenched by sheets of rain, blinded and deafened by lightning strikes so close I jumped at every thunderclap. The mess was relatively close to our rooms, but I was disconcerted by the gradually increasing list of the grating below my feet. Angling up and into the wind-blown rain felt like climbing a steep hill in a hurricane. When I got inside my room, the angle wasn't that bad, but the wind and water made it seem worse. Our bags had been brought up to the cabins as promised. I hoped the plane had made it safely away from the storm as I changed into sleeping attire.
I was awakened from a dreamless sleep by a horrible high-pitched metallic groaning sound, followed by a thunderous crash and shouts.
My room shook violently.
Jumping out of bed, I scrambled to put on my wet clothes and jacket, thinking it pointless to wear dry ones in the storm. I carefully cracked the door open and peeked out to see Mr. Brown staggering towards my door, avoiding slicker-clad personnel running through the rain.
I shouted over the din, "Do you know what happened?"
All I could get out of the crew, he paused as a lightning strike stunned him, was that a construction vessel anchored away from us drifted back and collided with the superstructure.
Who knows what damage it caused below decks?
I suppose we can go to the galley and find out if there is an evacuation order or anything.
Well, let's get moving before we get wetter than we need to be.
We struggled against the wind and rain to close the door to the mess behind us and found it crammed with people, mostly young paper pushers in disarray, crowded around a loudspeaker. A stern, gravelly voice issued instructions and updates. Need to report to the crane on platform B and be ready to move wreckage as soon as the salvage team has completed their duties.
All non-essential personnel are to return to and remain in their rooms. Runners will check each room for accountability within the next 10 minutes.
Once in contact with a runner and signed off on the roster, you are free to move about on important business only. Avoid the infirmary, wreck deck, galley, halls 2A, 2B, and 3A, and stay out of the way of repair crews.
The all-clear signal will be 3 consecutive siren blasts.
If none is heard by 0800 tomorrow, sack meals will be brought to each room along with a written dispatch detailing operations until the all-clear signal is sounded. Please relay this message to anyone not within earshot as it will only be broadcast once. Would John Slate please report to room 237? Repeat, John Slate, you are needed in room 237. He continued after a short pause.
Volunteers are needed on the construction ship Lorraine for salvage operations. Any qualified individuals, please meet on gangway C for tug transport. Please clear the galley and prep for overflow medical support for non-critical injuries. That is all for now.
We decided it was best to return to our quarters. The remainder of the night was relatively quiet, except for the howling wind, rain, and thunder.